Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 22nd of February, these are our main stories. Albania's parliament ratifies a controversial asylum deal with Italy. Also, the former Brazilian footballer Dani Alves is jailed in Spain for 4.5 years for a sex attack. We report from a plane trying to drop aid in northern Gaza. And analysis on Moscow as a Russian official looks away when confronted by G20 leaders about the death of Alexei Navalny. Also in this podcast.
Globally, they are the leading cause of early death, so they've overtaken tobacco. And we need to use a tobacco control approach.
Why experts say eating ultra-processed foods should be seen as similar to smoking cigarettes. Albania's parliament has ratified a controversial asylum deal with Italy, which will see two reception centres set up on Albanian territory for migrants rescued at sea by Italian authorities. In return, Albania will receive up to $650 million over a period of 5 years for the construction and operation of the hubs. In a noisy session peppered with horns and whistles, the deal passed with the backing of 77 MPs out of the 140-seat parliament, with the opposition boycotting the vote.
Prekliqë për ratifikimin e protokollit ndërmjet Këshillit të Ministrave të Republikës Shqipërisë dhe Qeverisë së Republikës Italiane.
Well, earlier I spoke to the BBC's Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay, who has been following the votes in Tirana.
Actually, funnily enough, it's more like business as usual in Albania's parliament over the past couple of months. There's been a lot of protests by opposition MPs, and not just about this issue, but they have been fairly steadfast in their opposition to this deal between Albania and Italy about these asylum processing centres. The opposition argument was that the deal violated Albania's sovereignty, therefore also Albania's constitution. That went all the way up to the Constitutional Court, which narrowly ruled that their case didn't have validity. In other words, that it was constitutional and that the vote could go ahead. But yeah, the opposition certainly weren't happy about it. There have been protests on the streets this week in Albania by the opposition, and this will give more fuel to those. It's interesting also to get the reaction from Prime Minister Edi Rama. The way he's playing this, he's saying this is showing Albania is standing together with Italy by choosing to act as an EU member state and agreeing to share a burden that Europe must bear united as one family in the face of a bold challenge. So Albania, as people may or may not know, has received the green light to start EU accession talks. Mr. Rama, the Prime Minister there, saying, right, this is us acting as a member of the European Union.
Guy Delaunay there, and with reaction from Albania. What, though, about Italy? I spoke to the BBC's Rome producer, Davide Ghilioni. I asked him how the news is likely to go down in Italy, and with Giorgia Meloni, who has campaigned against immigration.
Obviously, for Meloni, this is a major victory, I would say, although from a symbolic point of view mainly. But obviously, that's what she promised before she was elected. She really went big on migration. We do know that her party has like roots in the far right, and she's been campaigning against the illegal migration. She promised that she would send illegal migrants back to northern Africa, which is where they come from mainly when they arrive in southern Italy. But as soon as she was elected, she clearly struggled because numbers keep going up, and it's not that easy. We do know that migration is one of the most complicated issues to solve logistically and politically, but this time she managed to strike a deal with Albania, and she can show her voters that she's actually doing something for the first time. We do know that like many previous governments failed to do so. So she's actually doing something concrete.
Is anyone going to see a big change?
Well, it's hard to say, but I don't think so. According to analysts and observers and NGOs, this is not going to make a huge difference because the centres, the buildings are quite small. And also the type of operation they want to set up is quite limited as well because there will be two centres, essentially, one to process the migrants and one to accommodate them for a longer period. But the numbers are just so high that just two centres are able to accommodate a few hundred people will certainly not be enough.
Davide Chiglione. Aid agencies say hunger and disease are spreading in Gaza as the UK tries to drop in aid packages by air for the first time. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville was on one of the planes and sent this report as some of the first packages were offloaded.
So the men are just sweeping up here, the Jordanian Air Force crew. We're getting close to the drop zone over northern Gaza. There's pretty much no other way to get help to the remaining population here. Northern Gaza was the most densely populated part of the strip. It's now a wasteland. Most of the people have been forced south. The heavy Israeli military presence. There's still about 300,000 Palestinians there, and they're in desperate need. Because the UN says it's too much violence, it's looking chaos on the ground, but you no longer get aid from to that part of the Gaza Strip. We're about to open the door, it will fly out and land in northern Gaza. This is one of the few remaining ways to get help to the people trapped there.
That was Quentin Somerville reporting from a plane above northern Gaza. The former Brazil footballer Dani Alves has been found guilty of raping a woman in a Barcelona nightclub in 2022. Alves, a three times winner of the European Champions League with Barcelona and a member of Brazil's 2022 World Cup squad, was sentenced to 4.5 years in jail and ordered to pay his victim €150,000. Speaking outside the court, David Sainz, a lawyer for the victim, welcomed the decision.
We are satisfied because the sentence recognises what we have always said, that what the victim was saying she suffered had taken place. We have to review now whether the full content of the sentence, the severity of the penalty, is in line with the seriousness of the facts.
Our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, has been following the case.
In Spain, the definition of sexual assault has been broadened due to recent new legislation, so it's much broader than it was. So in the sentence, this was described as a sexual assault conviction, but in reality what it means is it is a rape conviction. So he was found guilty of luring this young woman into the toilet of a VIP section in a nightclub in Barcelona and raping her there. The woman in this case, the victim, had been calling for a 12-year jail term for him, and prosecutors have been calling for 9 years in jail. Instead, he got this 4.5-year jail term, and he will be supervised for another 5 years after that, once he is released from prison.
Incredibly well-known name. Any reaction in so far?
There hasn't really been a reaction from the football world. I mean, we have to remember that Alves is out of the sort of the top-tier football world anyway. He hasn't been playing for a top team for a few years now. But beyond that, there has been a response. I mean, his own lawyer has said that he will appeal against this conviction, and so he has the possibility to appeal before the Catalan High Court and then possibly the Supreme Court as well. There has been some political response as well. The Deputy Prime Minister, Yolanda Díaz, in the left-wing coalition government, said that she hoped this would serve as an example to discourage future sexist behaviour. So there is some response. I think we can expect more response to come over the coming hours.
And the issue of sexual consent, highly controversial issue, isn't it, in Spain?
Yes, it is. That is in great part because this government, the governments of Pedro Sanchez over recent years, the socialist prime minister, have made this something of a priority. So it's become very much a political issue, and it's been very much in the public domain, the issue of sexual consent. And of course, there was that new piece of legislation introduced a couple of years ago, broadening the definition of sexual assault and putting much more onus on a person accused of sexual assault in that they had to prove that they had gained consent from someone who was alleging that they were a victim of assault. So it's become a very sensitive issue and a very politicised issue as well.
Guy Hedgeco. To Japan now, and the floor of the Tokyo Stock Exchange. Applause from traders as the country's main Nikkei 225 stock index reached an all-time high, beating the previous record that had stood for more than 30 years. So why now? And what has changed? A question for our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
So the Nikkei 225 closed up more than 2%. It closed at 39,098. But earlier in the day, as you've said, it topped a previous high last set in December 1989, right at the peak of the 1980s bubble for Japan, before Japan entered years and years of recession, years that they call the lost decades.
Why this big rise now then?
Well, first, Japan has a really low currency in comparison, cheap currency in comparison to other countries, major economies around the world. The Bank of Japan has been actually trying to keep interest rates really low. That's in contrast to relatively high interest rates in lots of other places, in the US, the UK, for example. And so that's a real boon for Japanese corporations, companies that ship items elsewhere, like Toyota, the world's largest car manufacturer. It's able to make things in Japan and ship them elsewhere because of its cheap currency. It's keeping the cost of Japanese exports low. So that's why Japanese corporations and global corporations listed on the Japanese stock market are doing really, really well right now.
Cecilia, how big a moment is this then for Japan's economy?
Well, ironically, it's a terrible moment for Japan's economy. Japan's economy has actually just entered into a recession. Japan's big corporations are doing really well because of the stock market, because of the cheap yen, as I mentioned, because of changes to corporate governance that the Japanese government is really supporting at the moment. But the economy as a whole is suffering. You know, the cheap yen means that to import things into Japan, it's quite expensive. So for average families, anything that they want to buy that has to be brought into Japan, we have to remember Japan is just a series of islands. They have to import a lot. It's quite expensive. Japan also has an aging population. They've got a lot of labor market issues. It's very difficult to fill jobs. And so there's a lot of problems with Japan's wider economy, even though the stock market is really doing well and is having a moment.
Celia Hatton. In recent decades, ultra-processed food intake has increased dramatically worldwide, from fairly obvious things like candy, cakes and crisps, to seemingly more innocuous products like instant noodles or breakfast cereals. Well, these chemically processed foods tend to be high in fat, salt and sugar. The UK is one of the largest consumers of these foods in Europe. And now new research from the University of Oxford suggests almost 70% of food sales from its major manufacturers come from such products. So how serious is this? Stephanie Prentice has been investigating.
In a world of linguistic gymnastics when it comes to labelling foods, particularly from marketing departments, it's easy to lose sight of what an ultra-processed food is. Many foods are, of course, processed in some way, like pasteurising, but from a scientific perspective, something ultra-processed is also chemically processed. It will contain highly refined ingredients, artificial substances, chemical flavours, colours or sweeteners. People tend to be aware that the result of this processing tastes good, but relatively speaking, is nutritionally bad. But according to Dr. Chris Van Tulken, the author of Ultra-Processed People, eating these foods should, in his view, be regarded as a lifestyle choice like smoking.
Globally, they are the leading cause of early death. So they've overtaken tobacco. So the ancestry of these ultra-processed or high-fat salt sugar foods is in tobacco. The biggest tobacco companies in the world in the 1980s owned the biggest food companies. They used their marketing techniques, they used their flavor molecules to create the range of products that make up most of our diet today. They are addictive, they're incredibly harmful in a lot of different ways, but they definitely drive weight gain and malnutrition. And we need to use a tobacco control approach. And that's what I'm going to be saying in the Lords today.
He's referring to the House of Lords in the UK, where the issue is being raised by a campaign group. It suggests the solution starts before a customer even enters a supermarket, by controlling food advertising, and particularly for young people. 17-year-old Luke Hall is one of them.
I'll get up and maybe scroll on my phone and I might see an ad for a burger, and then I'll go and walk to the bus stop, and then there'll be an ice cream staring me back in the face, and then I'll turn my bus ticket over and there'll yet be another junk food ad, and I haven't even got to school yet and I've already been bombarded.
While burgers and ice creams are classic examples of unhealthy food, those who defend ultra-processed foods point out that some so-called health food, like tofu, also has to be highly processed, and that more nuanced labelling is what's needed, clarifying nutritional value. Dr. Chris agrees.
We should stick big black octagon warning labels according to the levels that we have agreed on as a nation on our food to warn people about those things. Because at the moment, if you buy a can of cola, it has three green traffic lights on it and one red for sugar. How can a can of cola have three green signals to proceed? My six-year-old can buy it in any shop.
Dr. Chris van Tulleken ending that report by Stephanie Prentice. Still to come in this podcast,
the mystery of the obscene little Hampton letter.
You foxy old.
And the swearing is taken from the real letters.
You really are a tricksy old.
The 100-year-old mystery of who was menacing an English village with extremely poisonous letters. Foreign ministers from eight countries have confronted their Russian counterpart at a meeting of G20 countries in Brazil over the death of Alexei Navalny and the war in Ukraine. Lord Cameron, Britain's representative, told the BBC that Sergei Lavrov looked away or at his phone when Russia was being criticised. Mr. Lavrov used his speech to the G20 to call allegations that Russia's leading dissident was murdered a fabrication. But crucial now in Moscow is also how the war in Ukraine is perceived 2 years after the full-scale invasion. These are the reflections of our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
Well, I'm standing by the Solovyetsky Stone, which is a Moscow monument to the victims of political repression. The old KGB building is just across the road. It's now headquarters of the FSB, Security Service. 5 days after the news of Alexei Navalny's death in prison, Muscovites are still coming here. Despite the heavy police presence, there are lots of officers around here standing, watching what is happening. People are coming, they're laying flowers, they're lighting candles, and they're standing in silence, clearly shocked at what has happened. Let's hear first from Sofia.
So I came yesterday and today. You feel a bit better after that.
What was your reaction on Friday when you heard the news about Mr. Navalny's death?
It was devastating. Really devastating.
On her phone here, Anastasia is listening to a song called Hope. Alexei Navalny had quoted lines from it in his final social media post to his wife, Yulia. Anastasia tells me that police have been detaining some people who've come out to commemorate Mr. Navalny. Putin feared Navalny when he was alive, she says. He fears him, even now Navalny's dead. Well, I've walked about 10 minutes down the road towards the Kremlin, and to be honest, it feels very strange because, in stark contrast to what I've just seen, it is an image of normality. And yet, just chatting to people around here, no one I've spoken to thinks the situation in Russia is normal. Alexander tells me that in 2 years the economy's got worse, and so has the general mood. Everyone's worse off, in the moral sense, Yelena says. It's terrible that people are being killed, so we try not to think about it. Well, I've left Moscow now. I've driven 40 miles to the town of Solnechnogorsk to hear what people are thinking away from the capital. I'm in the local park, and what's interesting here is that the last 2 years of Russian history are all around me. There's some graffiti in support of the Wagner mercenaries. There are some flowers I can see in memory of Alexei Navalny, and a giant mural of two local men who were killed fighting in Ukraine.
Я горжусь мужчинами, которые сейчас.
Марина tells me that she's proud of Russian men who, she says, have been doing their duty on the front line. Then she looks across at her 17-year-old son, Andrei. But as a mother, she adds, I'm scared that my son will be sent off to fight. That's why I want peace as soon as possible, so that we won't have to fear what tomorrow may bring. Everyone I spoke to, in Solnechnogorsk and in Moscow, said they wanted peace. But nobody believed that there was anything they could do, as individuals, as citizens of Russia, to make that happen.
Well, hearing that from Steve Rosenberg, it's hard to remember there was a time when Russia and the West spoke of cooperation and partnership. Over 20 years ago, the former Secretary General of NATO, George Robertson, visited Moscow and held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And Lord Robertson made these positive noises back then.
I am confident that this new level of cooperation between NATO's members and Russia will now change the world and for the better.
So what then has fundamentally changed? On a recent visit to London, Steve Rosenberg sat down with the former NATO chief to talk about Russia Today and Vladimir Putin.
The Putin I met with, did good business with, established the NATO-Russia Council with, is very, very different from this almost megalomaniac at the present moment. I think that Vladimir Putin has a very thin skin and a huge ambition for his country, an unrealistic ambition to be the equivalent of the USSR. The Soviet Union was recognised as the second superpower in the world. Russia can't make any claims in that direction. And I think that that sort of ate away at his ego. And you combine that with the feebleness sometimes of the West on display. I think that changed the individual who wanted to cooperate with NATO into somebody who now sees NATO as a huge threat.
Did you ever get the impression that Putin wanted to join NATO? Did he ever talk to you about that?
At my second meeting with Putin, he explicitly said, when are you going to invite Russia to join NATO? And I said, well, we don't invite countries to join NATO, they apply. I think he wanted it presented to him.
Vladimir Putin often expresses bitterness and resentment when he talks about what happened after 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union. And he claims that the West broke a promise. He claims that the West promised not to enlarge NATO an inch to the east. Was there a promise?
There was certainly nothing on paper. There was nothing that was agreed. There was no treaty to that effect. And again, it looks as though Putin is building a case, you know, on the basis of an assertion and then using everything to back it up.
What do we do now? I mean, we're 2 years into this war and so far away from the days that you were describing there when Russia was almost brought in to this family of nations.
There's only one thing that the Russian elite recognise, and that is strength. And maybe with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the failure to adhere to the red lines in Syria gave exactly the wrong signal to Putin about the resolution of the West. He's now got it really badly wrong. He wanted to stop the enlargement of NATO. Two new countries are joining. If Russia was to win and subordinate and destroy Ukraine as an independent sovereign nation state, then Vladimir Putin and the authoritarians of the world won't stop there. And there is no doubt at all that they are watching animatedly at the present moment. And we need to give them the right signals at the right time.
George Robertson. Next to what the UN has called one of the most complex humanitarian crises in the world. Almost 6 million people in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been displaced by ongoing fighting between the army and the rebel group known as the M23. In recent weeks, the clashes have moved close to one of the DRC's biggest cities, Goma, fueling government suspicion that the rebels could try to take it. The BBC's Marco Oriento reports.
It's early morning at the internally displaced people camp at Lushangala in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. A damp fog lingers in the air as women and girls patiently wait in line to refill plastic jerry cans with water.
Life has become very difficult. We lack sufficient food and proper shelter.
30-year-old Sifa Muhongo fled Sake, a town less than an hour drive away from here. Her life has been upturned by tragedy.
Life back home was good. I used to go to the farm to work my land and gather vegetables for me and my children. One day while I was gathering firewood in the forest, I was sexually assaulted by armed men.
More than 2.5 million people have been displaced in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo since October. Violence has erupted across their towns as the army tries to crush the expansion of the armed rebel group known as the M23. The road connecting the mountain village of Masisi to Lushangala is busy with motorbikes loaded with rolled-up mattresses. Next to them walks a steady stream of people carrying the few essential items they were able to collect before fleeing home.
I have found some relief in sleeping at the camp because I no longer hear the constant gunfire.
Timothy Ngarambe, a father of three, made this journey when violence broke out in his own village.
I cannot even begin to compare the quality of life I once had to the current conditions in this camp. The suffering we endure here is incredibly difficult to bear. The only solution for finding peace and returning home is for the government to expel the rebels from the country.
The DRC government and the M23 are fighting over the management of precious mineral resources and political influence. But as the strife continues, aid agencies fear a worsening of the health conditions of the people escaping violence. The M23 rebels say they want to be integrated into the Congolese National Army and become a recognized political party. But DRC's communication minister Patrick Muyaya says the country is not open to talks with the M23 and accuses neighboring Rwanda of supporting them.
One thing must be clear is that we as government will never negotiate with M23. M23 doesn't exist. It's Rwanda acting with his puppet.
Rwanda has consistently denied backing the M23 rebels in DRC. Meanwhile, as the dialogue between the two sides stalls, ordinary civilians continue to suffer.
Marco Oriento reporting. X, formerly known as Twitter, has admitted taking down accounts and posts related to the farmers' protests in India on government orders. The platform has launched a legal challenge. The BBC's Yogita Limaye reports.
A few days ago, a number of accounts of journalists and activists posting about the farmers' protests were withheld by X, formerly known as Twitter. The microblogging site has now clarified in a statement that this was done to comply with executive orders issued by the Indian government, failing which X could be subject to penalties, including significant fines and imprisonment. The company said it disagrees with the actions and maintains that freedom of expression should extend to the posts withheld.
Yogita Limaye. Now, let's go west.
This ain't Texas. Oh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down, 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 down. So pocket Lexus.
Beyoncé's decision to pivot to country music has paid off. She's become the first black woman ever to have a number one on the US Billboard country music chart. When one country radio station refused to play her song Texas Hold'em, it sparked an outcry from fans. But the row showed just how hard it is for black singers to break into this genre of American music. In 2022, black artists received less than 1% of airplay on country music radio. Julie Williams is an African-American country singer-songwriter based in Nashville. She told Regina Vaidyanathan that country music owes a great debt to black people and that Beyoncé has gone back to her roots.
She grew up in Houston. She grew up in Texas. Black people have been in country music for years, although that's not maybe what you think of when you think of American country music. So it's a very exciting time, not only for Black fans and folks who are getting to discover country for the first time, but also for a lot of Black and mixed country artists like myself who have been out here trying to make a name for ourselves in this town and to get some recognition and to see someone as amazing as Beyoncé have this number one success, historic success. It's inspiring for us.
We're making a lot of the fact that she is the first Black woman to top these charts. But you're saying that country music has always been part of Black culture as much as white culture in the US.
Yep. Black folks actually made country music in the United States. The banjo, which a lot of us think of when we think of country music, was created by slaves. Country music as we think of it now actually came from minstrel shows in which white folks were making fun of Black music. And then it ultimately got incorporated and changed and was seen as this creation of white people. But it really was, it came out of Black music at that time. And as country has gone along, it has turned into this genre that you think of as very white, male dominated, with women out of the picture, Black artists out of the picture, queer artists out of the picture. But a lot of us are here trying to tell our stories and find audiences. So Beyoncé is already doing with In Texas Hold'em, Rhiannon Giddens' banjo is right at the beginning. Is my hope is that it will educate people to know that Black people have a place in country music. Already, I've even found on my own social media, just by Beyoncé posting her music and then us saying, hey, if you love listening to Beyoncé, check out these other artists. We've seen some smaller independent Black artists go viral because they're going directly from fan to artist rather than through these gatekeepers that have historically kept Black folks out of that conversation.
I'm a Southern girl with her own kind of Southern curl.
Julie Williams and her song Southern Curls. Well, let's end this edition on something less harmonious. A showdown between two neighbours that sent a British seaside town into a frenzy. 100 years ago, that has now been turned into a comedy starring Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley. In 1920, police in Littlehampton, a town on the south coast, were on the hunt for the person behind some ill-tempered letters, to say the very least, that were sent to respected members of the community. But who was sending them? Our culture reporter, Yasmin Rufo, has been talking to the stars of the film.
The mystery of the obscene Littlehampton letter.
Parliament absolutely did debate it, and it was covered by all the broadsheets at the time.
The Home Secretary, Mr. Edward Short, was compelled to answer a question in Parliament about the ever-growing scandal.
And the nation was gripped by this.
Dear Edith, you foxy ass old.
And the swearing is taken from the real letters.
Carry on. You really are a tricksy old.
It's 1920, and in a sleepy seaside town in the south of England, Edith Swan, played by Olivia Colman, accuses her neighbour, Rose Gooding, played by Jesse Buckley, of writing poison pen letters.
I couldn't believe that it was a real story, but I was really glad it was.
Yeah.
You daft old...
I swear, and if people's sphincters tighten because I swear, I just think, I'm not killing anyone, I'm not hurting anyone. You know, some people, I think, walked out of the cinema and just think, ah, get over yourselves.
They really need to have a good swearing.
They need a good swear.
I forgive you, Rose.
Edith, I didn't do it.
While the police were certain that Rose was behind the sweary letters, one female police officer had her doubts.
Rose is about to go down for something she didn't do.
I'm not standing for it.
I should think not.
The woman who is the most fundamental to cracking the case is Gladys Moss.
Historian Emily Cockayne researched the Littlehampton libels for her recent book, Penning Poison.
She clearly has a different sense about what is happening.
Does Gladys Moss ever get the recognition for what she did in cracking the case?
Of course she didn't, no. Gladys Moss had, the year before, had to fight for her job, and an intervention of local influential women had helped her to keep her job.
It's like a trapdoor to hell opens up everywhere you tread.
I'm not actually evil, you know.
No, but you've got evil in you.
No one could have imagined the impact these anonymous letters would have had on the country.
I guess in modern day, you kind of expect some sort of sensationalist trolling, unfortunately, but for it to happen in the 1920s and through letters and to have sent up not just a little village in England into a frenzy, but a whole country, it was shocking.
Yeah, yeah. I love the level of shock, and I feel sad that the shock doesn't happen anymore. It's just commonplace. Everybody's cruel to everybody else online, mm-hmm. and that's awful. And I would love to go back to the days of it's not okay.
How do you think society has sort of changed? Why has that sort of become acceptable now, but 100 years ago was so awful?
I suppose it's so hard to police, isn't it? It's the anonymity of it. I mean, it doesn't take away the fact that it's a horrible thing. Yeah. It's a despicable thing to do to someone.
Our culture reporter, Yasmin Rufo. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper. The producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.